It's Monday, March 17, 2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. All right, good night. Those words are not only haunting now because they were the very last recorded words from Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, but they're also haunting in a very special way now because we know that those words were spoken after someone was already intentionally shutting down the communications data technology on the airliner. Malaysian Flight 370 has now been missing over a week, and it is now extremely urgent that the world find out what happened to that airliner and the 239 souls aboard. In a hastily called news conference last Saturday, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Rajib Nazak, admitted that his country had made horrifying strategic mistakes in this incident. In the first place, the search for the airliner for several days was in a region of the world where it is now unlikely, in the extreme, the jet not only is, but ever was. Furthermore, it is now known that this jet crossed across Malaysian airspace and was not even detected by the Malaysian Armed Services. It was never identified. It was never intercepted. It was never followed. And what we have here is a massive failure, not only of intelligence gathering systems, but of the people who are supposed to be monitoring them. And this, we might point out, in one of the most strategically and militarily tense portions of the world. We also know that right now the most logical two people who could account for how this plane was lost are the captain and the co-captain of the first officer. They're Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah, age 53, and Farik Abdul Hamid, age 27. They're both Malaysian citizens. Law enforcement officials in Malaysia have not identified them as suspects, but they are the obvious first consideration when trying to figure out who could have taken this plane, where it could have gone, and who would have had the ability not only to fly the plane, but to turn off this information technology, its location and communications technologies. But as the New York Times reported on Sunday, there are horrifying new data points for consideration here. For one thing, it is now known that the aircraft was flown for some time as high as 45,000 feet. Now, the ceiling or the maximum high altitude for that aircraft, the Boeing 777, is 43,100 feet. Why would it go to 45,000 feet? Aviation experts say it could only be done by a very skilled pilot. It would take an incredible amount of piloting skill to get the plane up to that altitude and for it to fly level at that altitude. Furthermore, the oxygen level would be so low at that altitude that almost certainly anyone without oxygen would have passed out, become unconscious, and perhaps already died. There is speculation, as horrifying as it may sound, that whoever was in charge of this airliner flew it up to that altitude in order to kill all of the passengers in order to have control of the airplane. That's not known at this point to be absolutely true, but at this point it is hard for anyone to imagine how those who did not have access to oxygen could have survived at that altitude for any length of time. As a matter of fact, some aviation experts also suggest that it's incredible just on its face that the aircraft was able to be controlled at that altitude for some length of time. It then went down to approximately 23,000 feet, and at that point, it is no longer traceable by radar as it went even lower. And that, of course, raises the obvious issue that someone was doing this. Someone was doing this who understood radar, who understood the technology of the aircraft, who understood how to fly it. What we don't understand is why. From a Christian worldview consideration, this new information makes the situation both easier and more difficult to understand. Easier in one sense. As Christians, we understand the importance of human moral behavior. We understand that human beings are capable of doing horrifying things. And when something like this points to the reality of an intelligence behind it, we come quickly to the assumption that this is a human intelligence given over to some malevolent plan, in this case, likely a murderous plan. But it's also more difficult to understand, because we don't understand at this point what point was behind this action. We don't understand what the motivation was. And the Christian worldview also leads us to understand that something of this kind of complex sophistication requires an incredibly urgent motive. We don't know what that motive was. We do know this. No motivation, no matter what that motivation might be, can justify what's taking place here. But when we're looking for motivation, we're not always looking for justification. We're looking for explanation. Because the way God made us, we want to know. We want to understand our own behavior, and we want to understand the behavior of others. We most desperately want to know where this airliner and those passengers are. But we also want to know, and we know we want to know, why this has happened. Next, back during the Cold War in the 20th century, writers such as George Orwell pointed out that elections aren't always elections. Sometimes they're political charades put on to give the veneer of respectability to what isn't at all respectable. That's what took place yesterday in the Crimean Peninsula when a poll hastily put together by the Crimeans under the influence of the Russians found that, according to the vote taken yesterday, over 95%, 95.5% of those in Crimea who voted are in favor of leaving Ukraine and joining Russia. There's no surprise in this. This snap election, this snap plebiscite, was exactly, as it turned out, what everyone expected it to be. A power play by Russia to try to justify its annexation of Crimea by military force or by whatever force is necessary. We're looking here to return to the tensions between the East and the West that marked most of the 20th century. And even as we had hoped that these tensions had largely gone away in the modern world, in the 21st century, we now know that they are back with a vengeance. Last night, Russian President Vladimir Putin told American President Barack Obama that the referendum endorsing Crimea becoming part of Russia was legal. Why? Because he says it is, and should be accepted. Why? Because he's not going to give it up. And that was according to the Kremlin. President Obama said that the United States rejects the results and warned that Washington is ready to impose financial sanctions, political sanctions, and other sanctions on Moscow over the crisis. But as President Obama, leaders of the European Union and others are having now to recognize, President Putin really doesn't care what they think. Furthermore, United States Secretary of State John Kerry said there will be consequences if Russia annexes the Crimea, but of course, what those consequences are, no one knows. Because as everyone now knows, the United States is not going to go to war over this. The only consequences that actually might apply are economic and political consequences, and as the Russian president has made clear, he's quite willing to pay those consequences. From a Christian worldview perspective, what this situation underlines perhaps more than anything else is that the world system, made up of governments and nations, simply doesn't play according to the playground rules that rather naive people think the world should follow. It's not that the world shouldn't follow such rules of fairness and equity and justice. It's just that world history indicates that over any period of considerable time, there are actors on the world stage who flaunt those rules and, frankly, take advantage of the naivete of other nations in so doing. And that's exactly what Vladimir Putin has done in this situation. He has taken advantage of the rather deadly naivete of many in the West. He knows that people in the West believe that he will act as we will act and think as we will think, but he doesn't think nor act as Western nations do. He's not concerned with the kind of reputation and international stability that we prize in the West. He is not a respecter of individual liberty, as those who have been his political prisoners could give eloquent testimony. You have a man here who is a new Russian nationalist, and as he is a new nationalist for Russia, he's simply following in the long tradition of Russian nationalism that goes all the way back to Peter the Great and the Tsars. Also, he is more popular politically right now in Russia than he has been at any point during his presidency. And that's explained by the fact that he has hit a nerve of nationalism within that country that deeply resonates with the resentments of the Russian people. They look back to the empire that Russia once was under the Tsars, and they look back to the empire that the Soviet Union was during the Cold War, and now they look at all the failures of Russia, and they blame outsiders for the failures of their own country. Vladimir Putin, who has presided over those failures, knows that it is to his political advantage to make the people of Russia believe that they are the victims of outside influence and that they are going to be the victors by means of imposing their nationalistic will, at this point, on the people of Crimea. But world history also indicates that Vladimir Putin is already adept at this. Going all the way back to 2008 and 2009, he effectively annexed portions of Georgia, and his troops are still in control of those regions even now. What that points out is that Western economic and political sanctions are actually not all that effective in dealing with Russia. They might be effective in dealing with other countries, and they're certainly sending danger signals to Russian business. But at the end of the day, Putin is going to go with nationalism over his own economic self-interest. And in so doing, Vladimir Putin clearly intends to be seen by the people of Russia as a new czar in the line of Peter I, or a new Soviet leader in the line of Joseph Stalin. Both of these figures, by the way, have become increasingly popular in Russian political culture just in recent years. Why? Because they represent a vision, or at least a remembered vision, of what Russian greatness looked like. Of course, that vision of greatness whitewashes much of history, but that's what nationalism does. If nothing else, the crisis in the Crimean Peninsula indicates that history is not over, that historical grievances tend to come up again and again in the present and the future, and the fact that we live in a fallen world. Not only do we see individual criminality and individual misbehavior, we see nations misbehave and engage in criminal behavior also. In this case, it's not stealing from the store down the street, it's stealing from the country right next to you. But it is stealing. It's the stealing of an entire historical peninsula of people. It's not only land, it is the people who are within that land. It has a long and bloody history going all the way back to the 17th century. And Vladimir Putin now believes it's to his advantage to take it, because he wants it. And at this point, no one can stop him. Next, as we have seen over and over again, the issue of marijuana is one of the most significant moral issues of our time, in terms of pointing to the way that moral change happens. And as we've seen, it's not only moral change, it is also a legal revolution. And it's one of the most revealing insights into the moral change that has taken place within a secularizing United States. And, of course, where you have the opportunity for this kind of moral change and political and legal change, you also have the opportunity for economic gain. And that became abundantly clear over the weekend. Two major articles in the national press. First of all, in the Wall Street Journal, the weekend interview was with Justin Hartfield, the founder of a website known as weedmaps.com. He's already made millions. His website brings in $25 million a year in revenue. He says now he intends to be what he calls the Philip Morris of the marijuana business in the United States. Then Jane Clark, writing at USA Today, writes about a meeting in Denver, a convention of ganjapreneurs, those who are intending to also make millions of dollars off the legalization of marijuana. But as both of these articles make abundantly clear, those who are behind this business are willing to skirt the law as closely as they can to not going to jail in order to push their economic ambitions. First of all, looking at Justin Hartfield's interview with the Wall Street Journal, this is the man who says he intends to be the Philip Morris of marijuana. He reveals that his company has been bringing in about $25 million in revenue by raiding and identifying marijuana outlets across the United States. He's been high since 13, the 30-year-old said. Prohibition's about to pop, he declared, and the people that were here before, if they're positioned intelligently, will reap a profit. I think we're positioned really well, end quote. As Barry Weiss of the Wall Street Journal explains, as states legalize marijuana, Mr. Hartfield is executing an internet-age version of the strategy. He's building and investing in some of the country's leading marijuana technology companies. He wants to do everything from providing pot quality evaluations to the cannabis connoisseur to eventually selling the plant itself. He said, quote, marijuana is not going to be profitable to make in the long run. It's going to be a dollar a gram. And so someone needs to step in and make it profitable to grow. I'm the best guy to do it, end quote. So says the man who declares himself the would-be Philip Morris of marijuana. In an interesting twist on the economic angle, Mr. Hartfield says he's the one to step in right now because the more mainstream tobacco companies and other similar corporations won't get into it until it's completely legal. Then he says they're going to have to buy me out. In his words, quote, by that time, they're going to buy me and then do it. And they're going to do it right because I'm going to be the one leading the charge, end quote. In his own words, quote, I'm just doing everything I can in this industry legally that isn't going to throw me in jail, end quote. Hartfield says the big money is to be made in evaluating and rating the various marijuana strains, and there are many of them. Eventually, almost an endless variety would be possible. He says you need to rate them according to taste and experience and the potency, how much of THC a particular strain has. The market, he says, is worth billions, and it's permanent. He calls it PERMA, because every batch needs to be tested. He says this is even more micro because there's a crop every 4 months and not every 2 years. In other words, this is even better than the wine business in terms of rating because the wines come in about every 2 years with different varietals, but when it comes to marijuana, about every 4 months someone's got a new variety. He says, we want to be the wine.com of the marijuana business. There are a couple of very revealing aspects to the interview he gave with the Wall Street Journal. For one thing, he absolutely punctures the idea that there is almost any validity or integrity to the whole idea of medical marijuana. He says, it took me $150 and under an hour to get a card from a physician in Venice, California, even after I admitted I was just in town for a visit. He says his malady was, quote, stressful deadlines, end quote. But he also admits he's going to use whatever argument is necessary in order to get his point because he says, quote, I care about the least amount of people suffering under prohibition. And by suffering, he doesn't mean any kind of necessarily identifiable or diagnosable medical malady. He just means they're suffering from lack of access to marijuana. His worldview becomes very apparent in this article. He says, quote, this is America, right? We're still allowed to have for-profit business, and people are still allowed to make choices for themselves, and we know that prohibition doesn't work from alcohol. It's not a bad thing, he says, if people smoke pot to get high. We're not stopping human beings from using drugs, so let's let them use the best one, the safest one available, end quote. Even the Wall Street Journal has the integrity to come back and say, not so fast. It isn't so safe, especially on the developing brain, and especially when it comes to teenagers. But Hartfield has a ready response to that, as you might expect. He argues, according to the Journal, that these susceptible teenagers will have a much harder time getting marijuana if it's legalized and regulated. In his words, quote, When marijuana goes off the black market, it will only be available in the public market and in the stores like alcohol is. No one's making moonshine, end quote. Of course, what that misses is the point. No one's making moonshine in this sense because no one has to. Alcohol is so readily available that teenagers can get it with just the slightest amount of ingenuity, and that's what they're already doing with marijuana. As we have reported repeatedly, it is already acknowledged by public health experts that the first cigarette most teenagers in America now smoke is not a tobacco cigarette, but a marijuana cigarette. And it's not legal anywhere for a teenager to have access to marijuana. It's not stopping them. Oh, two other aspects of this article that you should note. One is that the marijuana industry is spending a lot of money for political influence. Weed Maps, that's Hartfield's company, alone spent $1 million last year in lobbyists and charitable contributions to political causes. But he also sees it as part of a larger moral revolution, and this too is important. He said, quote, "What happened with gay marriage is going to happen with marijuana. Give me 24 months," end quote. So he is not only intending to profit by a moral revolution, he's going to time it for us. Just 24 months. Meanwhile, back to Jane Clark writing about that ganjapreneur convention in Denver. She says that marijuana tourism has become a big business there in Colorado. She wrote, quote, "It was bound to happen. Even before Colorado's law legalizing the recreational use of marijuana took effect January 1, ganjapreneurs were conjuring ways to cash in on the green rush." Notice the language, ganjapreneurs, green rush. They're even vocalizing this in terms of language. She writes that no fewer than a dozen tour operators are already angling for business in what she calls, quote, "this new breed of mile-high city visitor." Options range from a chauffeured VW bus making the rounds of marijuana dispensaries to multi-dimensional excursions like one known as My 420 Tours Outings, which includes a cooking with cannabis class, visits to dispensaries and a grow facility, and transport via a snack-equipped party bus, end quote. Matt Brown, head of the My 420 Tour, said, quote, "We didn't invent the idea of smoking pot on vacation. People who come here are able to walk down the street with a joint in their pocket with no paranoia. We're like your Colorado friend who holds your hand and shows you this is real," end quote. But as Jane Clark points out, hand-holding evidently doesn't come cheap. They're charging $1,000 per person, including airport transfers. Oh, and some of the ganjapreneurs are quite dietarily conscious. At least one of the cooking schools is offering a menu of, quote, "cannabis-infused gluten-free trail mix, chocolate truffles, and pumpkin muffins," end quote. Instructor Blaine Alexander, owner of Conscious Confections there in Denver, said, quote, "They're delicious and they'll get you so stoned," end quote. Blaine went on to say, quote, "People may have tried to bake the standard pot brownies at home, but this is showing a different level of cooking. The goal is to make Denver the Napa Valley of cannabis," end quote. But just as the Wall Street Journal was honest about the fact that teenagers are getting access to this presumably restricted substance, so also USA Today is honest about the fact that the marijuana we're talking about here is far more potent than marijuana was just a generation ago. Mary Sharp, age 39, said, quote, "We were surprised how potent it is after she consumed half a chocolate confection infused with hash oil," quote, "and got lost in their hotel on the way to their room," end quote. That didn't stop her husband, Robert Sharp, from saying, quote, "For us, this is above and beyond getting stoned. He says they want to take the cooking course, quote, because we want to learn how to be healthy," end quote. On the My 420 tour, one of the tour guides advised not eating the entire brownie because if you do, you won't remember the tour. But the Christian worldview steps in to say, in a story like this, there is no such economic opportunity that is not laden with moral responsibility. The one thing that no one in any of these articles apparently intends to take. But it also tells us that when a moral revolution like this is taking place, there are those who see the opportunity not only to make millions or billions of dollars, but to make a name for themselves, to create an artistry out of this, to make Denver the Napa Valley of marijuana, to come up with marijuana tours that people will want to come to from all kinds of nations and states across the United States. But even as the states of Colorado and Washington have pioneered this, other states are almost certain to follow. That after Colorado announced just about a week ago that it was raising millions of dollars every month in tax revenue from the sale, the legal sale, of what's called recreational marijuana. In a fallen world, people will find just about any justification to make money. And they will see a hunger, and they will see a customer market, and they will try to direct their products to it. That's exactly what the ganjapreneurs are doing. That's exactly what Justin Hartfield intends to do as the Philip Morris of marijuana. And anyone who needed the Christian worldview affirmation that economics is deadly serious moral business need look no further than these two articles over the weekend. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Remember, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Just call us at 877-505-2058 with your question in your voice. That's 877-505-2058. Ask Anything Weekend Edition, released every Saturday. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.